Right, ladies, we're on sheet 46. We're into the Rishonim, and there are things that we need to go through today which will hopefully be of interest and build your understanding of really where Torah comes from. Because again, this is what we're truly trying to aim for. We're trying to get to an understanding of the modern concepts of Psak, and we are now into the period of Rishonim. Let me give you a little bit of a run-in. We talked about the Ga'anim, we talked about the Chasimah Sashas, we talked about the fact that the Gemara was sealed with a Jewish acceptance of the fact that this is now the source of Halakha. We talked about the fact that the community then split into two, an Ashkenaz community up in Northern Europe at the top there, and a Sephardi community in North Africa and Spain.
Did you do that?
Yeah. Wow. Just from memory, just to inform. The Sephardi community, of course, was living in an Islamic country, and the Ashkenazi Islamic area, the Ashkenazi were living with the Christians, and therefore there wasn't that much connection between them because there was a state of war going on for much of the period of the Middle Ages. The Ga'onim, of course, were based in Babel. Where is Babel? So, as we've talked about before, Babel is up here. Okay? So this is Babel. And really, this was the center of the Jewish world for the entire period of the Ga'onim. Everything came out from there. To whatever, and everyone's money came into there. So Torah and Psak was coming out from Babel, based in, of course, the Talmud Bavli, and money was coming into Babel.
Where
now, Yerushalmi was sidelined to a large degree. The theory is, and I said before, the theory is that the Yerushalmi was preserved more in Eretz Israel, through to the Jews of Italy, and maybe up through to the Ashkenazim like that. Maybe that the Ashkenazim were based more in the Yerushalmi than the Sephardim, but there are people that disagree with that. If you're interested, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the son of Rav Yoshebeth Soloveitchik, his speciality, he's a historian as well. At the time of Chacham, he's a historian, and his specialist area is Ashkenaz in the early Middle Ages, and therefore if you want to read thousands of pages of fascinating material on that, that's his one to read. Now, one of the things that started to happen during the time of the Ga'onim is this power, if you like, that they held over the Jewish world. This is the entire world, as far as, I mean, apart from China, you know, it was only Jews in China, a few, this was the Jewish world. This hold on the Jewish world began to crack. And there were a few ways in which it cracked. First of all, the Ga'onim all came from Babel. Rav Sadia Gaon, one of the most famous Ga'onim in the 10th century, he came from Egypt. So that was already like a bit of a, whoa, came from Egypt. It's a bit like, you know, one of the Gedolei HaDor suddenly appearing from Canada. You know? I mean, there are some very great Talmudic Chachamim in Canada, don't get me wrong, but it's not it was slightly unexpected. And this is the sort of the resurgence, if you like, or the upswing of the North African communities. And then you have this story of, maybe it's a historical account, maybe it's more of a figurative account, of the four captives. Remember I mentioned this before? That there were four captives sailing from Brindisi, which is here on the tip of Italy. There were four rabbis, four Ga'onim, and they were taken captive by pirates, and they were then ransomed off to different communities around Europe, once to Spain, once to North Africa, etc. Now, the historical accuracy of this story is not really what I'm interested in now. But what this story is it's like a narrative that talks about how the major communities of outside Babel were really set up. So by the time the Rif comes on the scene, who we're talking about now, you have a significant community in North Africa, okay? The one of the four captives that was sent to North Africa was someone called Rabbeinu Chushiel. His son was Rabbeinu Chananel. Rabbeinu Chananel was a teacher stroke contemporary of the Rif. You can get a feel for how that worked. It's really the Rif that puts the nail in the coffin of the control of the Ga'onim over the Jewish world, because the Rif became really the major Gaon in the Jewish world. In fact, early in his life, people actually called him one of the Ga'onim. Okay? Until it became clear that this was a new period, and the Rif's centre of gravity was over here, up into Spain. And therefore, you can see how that had a major effect on the control of the yeshivas in Babel, Sura, Papadisa, etc. Right. We'll talk about the Rif's life in a minute, but that's a little bit of an introduction. Once the Gemara has been accepted and sealed, where can we get Halakha from? So I put on the top of the sheet, this is an important point. From the time of the Gemara up until the present day, there are now really three sources of Halakha. And they each have advantages and disadvantages. First of all, there's the Meforshim and Chidushim. People wrote Meforshim on the Gemara. People wrote Chidushim on the Gemara, Rashi and Tosfos and the Ran and all of these people. What are the advantages? Well, they're analytical. They give principles. They're general comments on the ideas. The problem is they're not written as a psak. You try and distill the psak of Rashi or Tosfos out from the commentaries of Rashi and Tosfos. It's not so straightforward to see what they actually sat beside halacha lemaisa, and therefore they're helpful for some things, but not as helpful for others. Then there are the codifications. People like the Rambam, we'll see specifically next time, the Rif to some degree, created books of halacha lemaisa, practical halacha books. So they're obviously very helpful in the sense that they're halacha lemaisa, you know exactly what they mean, they're very clear about what they mean, they cover all the standard cases. The problem is they don't show any of the analysis. How did they get to that sack? What were they thinking? How did they learn the sugya? And they don't cover every case. The third source, which we need to make sure we don't forget, is the Shailas and Tshuvas, what's often called Shutim. Shailas and Tshuvas are obviously written from the time of the Gaonim onwards, the Rishonim, the Achronim, and they're very helpful in the sense that they're very analytical. They can cover 30, 40 pages of analysis of a topic, therefore they give all the principles. The problem with them is that they apply to specific cases, the case that they were asked, and it's very difficult to sometimes to know exactly how they would apply outside those cases. Almost always the Shailas and Tshuvas were responses to questions that were actually asked. Occasionally people wrote books of Shailas and Tshuvas where they made up their own questions. Basically they just wrote a halacha book in the form of Shailas and Tshuvas. Perhaps the most famous one of all was someone called the Trumat HaDeshen, who was late Rishonim. The Trumat HaDeshen, who called his book the Trumat HaDeshen, because Gematria of Deshen is 354, correct? I have to be quicker on the arithmetic. And 354 is the number of days in the lunar year, okay? And it's like a Jewish number. So he wrote 354 Tshuvas and he called it the Tshuvas HaDeshen. The advantage is he made up his own Shailas and therefore he was able to come up with questions that nobody else would come up with. Yes? Yes, there is. They say this daka about the Shulman's edition and others. There is this idea that a Rav has a siyata de shemaya when he's giving a psak, and the question is whether that applies to someone who makes up. I've heard that said as well. Lemaisa, the Shulman's edition is accepted by the Ramah as a significant authority, and there are many of the psakim that we have a base in, so I don't know how far that goes. I think I've mentioned. I talked about Eliyahu Hanavi's wife. No. Maybe it was in my Shabbos class. One of the things that the Trumas HaDeshen is able to do when he makes up his own tshuvas, or own shailas rather, is he can talk about things that no one would ever ask him. For example, one of the things he asked there is when Eliyahu HaNavi went up to Shamayim in a fiery chariot, as we see in Sefer Melachim, would Mrs. Eliyahu HaNavi, Mrs. HaNavi, yeah, would she require a get if she wants to get married to someone else? Now, obviously, this is not a shaila that anyone had ever called him up and asked him. But he wants to know, does she need a get or not? Is she still married or is she no longer married that her husband has gone up to Shamayim but didn't die? So, what was the answer? So he comes up with the answer, it could be that she doesn't need a get. Why not? Because she's no longer an Ashes Ish. Because he's no longer an Ish. What is he?
Malach.
A Malach. She's an Ashes Malach. You have to read the tshuva there to see all the ins and outs. Why would he make up a question like that? I don't know. Interesting analysis. But you know something? In the modern day 20th century, 21st century halachic discussions, this is actually a very fascinating tshuva now about people who have gender reassignment surgery and turn from being women into men or men into women. Which is something which is not halachically permissible for a whole range of reasons. But if you have a woman whose husband has now had a sex change operation, he's become a woman, and he says to her, I'm not giving you a get, I still love you, I want to stay married to you. This was a case that happened a couple of years ago in not far from here, okay, from family. And he goes off and he has a gender reassignment and he says to her, I love you, I love the kids, I still want us to be a family. And she says, you forget that, you know, I'm not having this, I want to go marry someone else. Does she need to get a get or not? Is she still an Ashes Ish? Or is she now an Ashes Isha?
And to what extent is the tshuva of the Trumas Hadeshin relevant to this particular issue? Does the operation actually achieve a halachic change of gender, or does it not achieve that? But I'm just telling you, this is the things like the Trumas Hadeshin actually became quite helpful in that particular case.
Or what about if someone goes into a coma with a dash and it's like, what's that kind of thing?
Because someone going into coma doesn't cease to be the gender that they are.
No, but I'm saying to the case of, like, they're alive, but they're not really...
Yes, there are definitely shaylos. More so when if she, God forbid, goes into a coma, and he has a question now, can he marry a second wife? Where normally you would not be allowed to marry a second wife, but in this case, since that she's effectively a vegetable, whatever, she's no longer responsive, would that be one of the circumstances in which he'd be allowed to marry a second wife? If it were the other way around, it would not be a shaila. If it was the husband in the coma, she for sure would not be allowed to marry another man, because she's only allowed to have one husband, and he's still alive, and he's still a man. Yeah? So, but anyway, I'm not getting into that case now. You can discuss it in one of your other classes. But that's one of the fascinating things about shaila and tshuva. There's another shaila and tshuva that he mentioned in the piece here. Did you get this at the end? Shaila and tshuva's min ha-shamayim? You saw that? You read this little piece in the middle about the riff at the back?
Yeah.
He said, just look five lines up from the bottom. Where he's saying all these nice things about the riff and talk about his life and all that kind of stuff. He says, just five lines up in the middle, he says, "V'kasav Rabbeinu Yaakov mimarei, shehaya shoyel shailas mina shamayim." That Rav Yaakov mimarei is one of the French rabbanim. I think he was from Provence. He asked the shalis min hashemayim. I'll tell you what that is in a minute. Upam achashal al din. He asked once on a question, din echad, im alocha ba'aka arif, if the alocha is like the riv, the heshiva loy, and they answered him, min hashemayim, from shemayim, the vabra alocha ka arif, negid acholkin alav, the choshiv tuva. That the halocha is for sure like the riv, because he's such a choshiv a guy. What is shalis and shuvas min hashemayim? What is that? Have you heard of that before? Yaakov mimarei. He went into a trance, and he went up in a dream to Shamayim, and he asks all these interesting questions of the people that he, or the beings that he encountered in his trance, Mina Shamayim. And then he writes, you say that at least once every three lessons.
I get, because this is all really sketchy.
And he writes down in his sefer all the answers he gets. The question is that valid on any level, or is that invalid?
Invalid.
Because of?
Like, all of the issues. One, proof. Two,
right.
Who is this guy? Three, Lo Bashamayim, even if he's correct. And D, no.
Just that. Okay, I see that you feel fairly strongly about this.
Yes.
Yeah, the truth is, Joy, you're not alone in your concern. In terms of who is this guy, he was a bona fide Rishon, there's no question of his...
We'll go crazy.
Okay, but I don't think there's any evidence that he did that. Rav Yosef Karo.
Yeah, no, that's not it. No.
Rav Yosef Karo also had conversations with a Maggid that he spoke to. But it must be said, he doesn't codify them in Shulchan Aruch. You don't get any situation which he says in Shulchan Aruch, the Maggid told me that Aruch is like X, Y, and Z. He doesn't do that. He keeps a very clear separation between his Kabbalistic Maggid discussions. If you read his paper, Maggid Meisharim, he talks about that, and the Shulchan Aruch. I tell you, Maaseh Shehaya, I was once in yeshiva when I was a young man, and there was a fellow next to me leafing through Shailos and Tshuvos Min HaShamayim. And one of the Ramim came up to him and got very cross and said, "Put that down!" You know, so he said, "Why? It's interesting." He goes, "You know how many halachas are paskin from that in the Shulchan Aruch?" So he goes, "No." He goes, "Zero. And put that down, etc." However, it must be said that there are some halachas that are brought in the Achronim from Shailos and Tshuvos Min HaShamayim. There's a whole thing about piyutim and the use of piyutim. So it's not accepted as a mainstream sefer. It's not in any sense a major, even a minor source in halacha. It's hardly ever a source in halacha. But it's there. You should just be aware of it. One of the questions he feels that he... It's a very interesting question of itself. If you had the opportunity, leaving aside if you feel it's sketchy or not, if you had an opportunity to do that, what questions would you ask?
Is God real?
Is God real? Well, he didn't have that as a question. He didn't have that as a question, okay? And that's kind of the question that Moshe Rabbeinu asked up on Har Sinai. Not is God real in the sense that does God exist, but what is God? Which is more of an interesting question than is God real, because what do you have to just define what real means? He asked, of all questions, do women have to make a bracha when they shake lulav? That's one of the things he's really famous for. I don't know. It obviously doesn't bother him. Maybe it bothered him.
What did the
He said yes, actually, which is very interesting because the Sfardim do not make a bracha when the women shake lulav. And when this is brought in part of that discussion, people get very excited and upset about this whole thing. I don't know, maybe it was an issue for him, maybe his wife was upset about it, I don't know. But just of all interesting issues. Anyway, that's beside the point. So when you get down to the Rishonim, you have these different sources of halacha. You have the Chidushim, commentaries on Gemara, you have the codifications, and then you have the Shalas and Shuvas. Now, let's talk about the Rif for a second. If you look, please, in your sheets that I gave you, sheet 46 on the Rif. Ah, before we do the Rif, actually, let me just take you through this overview, which I think will be quite helpful. I have another copy somewhere. Just a second. That I gave you at the very beginning. Yeah, you've got this thing here? This thing, that the portrait thing? You got one of these? Everyone got one of these? Yes? Now, this is just by way of overview, just so you know where the household name Rishonim came from. Obviously, there were hundreds and hundreds of Rishonim. We usually use the expression Rishonim to mean the people, the rabbis, the commentators from the year 1000 to the year 1500. That is usually who we're talking about. Okay? We'll see that the cutoff date for the beginning and the end of the Rishonim, what's the matter? Oh, it's got two sides and they're different. No. You've got my original. You got my original? Yeah. Oh, fine. So you both got one page of my original. Right, you can share between you the, I think I've got another copy. No, I'll make you another one afterwards, all right? Don't worry about that. We'll talk about that in a minute. It's all right. You're not being left out. It's not always clear when the cutoff date is at the beginning or the end. When did the Rishonim start? I already told you that the Rif sometimes was seen as being one of the last of the Gaonim until it became clear he wasn't one of the Gaonim. Rav Hai Gon died in, I think, 1038 or something around there. Not far off the Battle of Hastings. The Battle of 1066 is when Rashi set up his yeshiva in France, as far as I'm aware. Very important date for the world, 1066, for that reason, if for none other. The Rif, of course, lived exactly the same time as Rashi. Except Rashi's living up here. Rashi's living up here in France. And the Rif is living down here in North Africa. Right.
How did it become clear?
Because it became clear over the course of the Rif's life that the centre of gravity of the Gaonim had now moved.
So it's just a geographical?
Yes, exactly. The Gaonim, why are the Gaonim called Gaonim? Because they're Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Gaon Yaakov. Gaon Yaakov. Gaon Yaakov is the name of the Yeshiva. And therefore, once the Yeshiva ceased to have predominance, there are no more Gaonim. Even by the time you should just know of the Rambam, when the Rambam was in Egypt, he was also still fighting 100 years after the Rif with the Gaonim about who is really in charge of the Jewish people. And there were Gaonim sending him, you know, letters saying, hey, we decide what goes on. We decide the this and that and the other. And the Rambam was saying, excuse me, with all respect, you're living in the past. This is not how it works anymore. We are now our own people. We have our own communities, which is an interesting point. So it took a while for that to really catch on. Yes.
So the Gaonim must have something to be in that Yeshiva, like the
yes. Yes, the heads of the academies of that Yeshiva.
Was it better that way to have it?
I don't know. It depends on who you ask. If you ask the Gaonim, it was better to have the Gaonim in charge. If you ask the others, it wasn't. You should just know that the Gaonim were not all massive Talmidei Chachamim. It's the Gaonim. Some of them were luminaries of the Jewish world. Some of them were more administrative. Just the fact that they were in the Gaonim doesn't give them that preeminence. And that also is one of the things that the Rambam argues with. He says, I don't think that we should be bound in any way by the Gaonim. That itself is a machlokes early on. The question is, which Gaonim? Some of the Gaonim were obviously very, very important. Rav Amram Gon, Rav Shrira Gon, Rav Hai Gon, Rav Sadi Gon, etc., etc. But some of them were administrators. Rav Herschel Schechter has a share on the Gaonim from YU. He says that some of the Gaonim were fundraisers, basically. So the shift of the centre of gravity was very important. Now, always based in Baba. Let's have a look at this sheet. So I want to go through a few centuries really, really quickly, so you get a bit of an overview.
How come they didn't want the Gaonim in Baba to be?
Who they?
The Jewish communities.
Didn't want them to be in charge?
Yeah. Because,
a few reasons. First of all, like, why should a community over here run a community over here?
So they wanted independence.
Right. Well, when they didn't really have any of their own leaders in the early days, in the 8th century, 9th century, so fine, so they turned to Baba for help. They needed Baba.
They needed their funding, they needed their support, their sack. But by the time you get to the 11th century, 12th century, they've got their own family, their chachamim, their own funding, their own... what do they need it for? This is a question today. Who controls the American Jewish communities? Are they controlled in any way by the Gedolim Yerushalayim of Bnei Brak? Or do they have their own complete independent function? And if the Gedolim in Bnei Brak and Yerushalayim decide that a certain thing has to be put in Cheirim and is absolutely acceptable, does that bind the people in America at all? This is still a question, and it becomes even more. Now, let's go, ladies, pick up this sheet. I want to make sure you get a bit of context. Obviously, my purpose here is not to give you hundreds of names and dates and places, but you need to understand where people fit into the Masorah, otherwise you won't have a clue. This is important for your knowledge of Pesach as well. So let's just go through it column and row. Let's start in the 11th century, 1000 to 1100. So I've divided it into three. Obviously, if you're Taimani, I apologize. It wasn't meant as a personal slur. There is a lot of stuff going on in other places than these three. There's obviously stuff still happening in Bavel, the Edut HaMizrach. There's still stuff going on in Taiman. But these are the three, for purposes of Halacha, these are the three major places. So, in that century, so in Spain and North Africa, there's a lot of people that you will have heard of. Rabbeinu Nissim. Don't get that Rabbeinu Nissim confused with the Rabbeinu Nissim who's a commentary on the Rif. He's one, same name, but he lived a few hundred years later in Spain. This Rabbeinu Nissim is one of the teachers, if you like, of the Rif. Rabbeinu Hananel, who is the son of Rabbeinu Hoshiel. Rav Shmuel Anagid, we talked about him, remember, when we talked about Midrash. He was effectively the Prime Minister of Spain under the Muslim rulers. Rabbeinu Bachya, you've heard of him? Again, there are two Rabbeinu Bachyas. There's Rabbeinu Bachya ibn Pekuda, who wrote the Chovas HaLevavos, he lived in Spain. And there's Rabbeinu Bachya ben Asher, who wrote the commentary of Rabbeinu Bachya on the Chumash. Do you know that?
Yeah.
That's why people sometimes get wondered. They say, I don't understand this. Rabbeinu Bachya on Chumash is quoting Rabbeinu Bachya. Like, how can that be? The answer is, two different people. I've seen people make that mistake. And then we have the Rif that we'll talk about in more detail. If you shift to France and Germany, what's going on at the same time? Well, obviously Rashi. We're not going to have a whole shiur dedicated to Rashi because we have to kind of cut it down. And in terms of Halacha, he's not the most important. We'll see the Rosh wraps a lot of that, those Ashkenazi Psakim up into the Rosh. Rabbeinu Gershom, he is a predecessor of Rashi, obviously very famous for his Cheirems. Why did he not make Gezeiros and Takonas? You know the answer to this. Because he couldn't. Why? Because he's no longer in charge of the Jewish people. After the Shas, there was no rabbinic authority, as the Rambam explained, over the entire Jewish people. So all you can do is have authority over your community. So he created the Cheirems. You know, you can't marry more than one wife, and you can't marry other people's male, and all of that stuff. You can't divorce a woman against her will, etc., etc. Rav Yaakov ben Yakar was one of the teachers of Rashi that Rashi quotes a lot. Provence, where is Provence? So this was your question, Joy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Go to Provence on holiday. I don't know about France these days, it's getting a bit ropey. But Provence is down here. Very nice. Nice. Mm-hmm. Nice. Mm-hmm. Marseille. Yeah. Good shopping. Close to the Alps. There are the Alps. Very nice Alps here. The point is, it's a nice place to go. I once went to the south of France with my wife on holiday. Perfect holiday. My wife and my daughter went shopping in Nice. Myself went hiking in the Alps. Like, everybody's happy. And then we met up in the evening. Ideal holiday, from all perspectives. Not that I don't like spending time with my wife. I do, but she doesn't like hiking and I don't like shopping. So it worked out really, really well. So, in Provence, there were other people there as well. Rashi quotes from Moshe Hadarshan, many of the Agaritas, etc. Fine. That's the first century. The second century, again, there's more people than this, but this is just for illustration. The 1100 to 1200. So you have Rabbi Huda Halevi, famous for writing the Kuzari. He was a student of the Rif, okay? You have the Ri Migash, very important, but you won't have heard of him because you won't have read much. We had one source once from the Ri Migash, and if you remembered which sheet that was on, I would give you a special bonus. I don't remember myself, but we once had a quote from him. He was the Rambam's father's teacher, exactly. He was a student of the Rif. Ibn Ezra, you know full well. Actually, there were two Ibn Ezras, Avraham and Moshe Ibn Ezra, distant cousins. Okay? And of course, the Rambam, who will get a sheet all unto himself right now. Over in France and Germany, there's a lot going on. This is the first century of what we call the Balei Tosfos, the students of Rashi, and the grand students. People like the Rashbam, if you know, if you've been studying Arabic, Sochim Rashbam is very big, Rabbeinu Tam, very big name, Rashbam's little brother. The Ri Hazakain, he was a cousin stroke. Yeah, little brother. Yeah. Rashbam was older, Rabbeinu Tam was younger. Grandchildren of Rashi. Okay.
Okay? The Sefer Yireim, Rabbi Eliezer of Metz, the Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid, the very Kabbalistic source, the Ashkenazim and the Mekubalim at this time, the Rash, all these people, some of them you will have heard of, some of them you won't. We could list another 50 names. Over in Provence, the most famous one that you need to know is the Balaam Or, which we'll see today on the Rif, and the Rivet, who has a lot to say about the Rambam. When you read the Rambam, you see the Rivet's commentary. Let's turn over to the 13th century. The 13th century in Spain and North Africa, lots of very famous people, Rabbeinu Yonah, bless you, okay, Rabbeinu Yonah and the Ramban, also they were sort of colleagues, if you like, the Rashba and the Ritva, they were all coming from the same Spanish school. France and Germany, you have the last of the Balei HaTosfos, the Smag, the Ozarua, and the Maharam of Rothenburg. The Maharam of Rothenburg was pretty much the last, he's the one that was captured by the Germans and imprisoned and ransomed, and he wouldn't let them pay the ransom, and he died in jail, etc. He was the, if you like, the last of the main Balei HaTosfos. Over in Provence, a few more people that you will have heard of: the Meiri, Chizkuni, you probably know him on Chumash, Radak, you probably know on Nach, etc. The last main century of the Rishonim was the 13th to 1400th century, and I'll tell you why that was in a minute. Back in Spain, you have Rabbeinu Bachya, the later one, okay? Spain was now largely Christian. We'll talk about that as we get through. The Abu Dharam, the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim, the later one. Over in France and Germany, you have the Rosh and the Tour, a father-son team. The Rosh was the father of the Tour, okay? And the Rosh is the student of the Maharam of Rothenburg, so he's really codifying the Psak of the Ashkenaz, the Maharil, who a lot of the Minhagim of Ashkenaz are in the Maharil. The last century of the Rishonim was a very weak one. There's almost nobody there. A couple of people I mentioned, the Trumas Hadeshen in Ashkenaz, the Sefer Ikrim. Why was that? So I'll say a word about that. According to many people, really the Black Death, which was in the 1340s, was pretty much the end of an era. Because it wiped out so many people, it killed so many people in all the communities, including the Jewish community. 25% of the Jewish community was wiped off the map, and which was less than the non-Jewish community, for all sorts of reasons which no one's entirely clear of, possibly to do with hygiene, to do with halacha, and because less Jews died, therefore the non-Jews blamed the Jews for having caused it, and there were massive pogroms, there were massacres all through Europe, and therefore that was really to a large degree the end. In Spain, the 1400s were very, very, very tense, because there was a lot of persecution, rising persecution by the Christians against the Spanish community. In Europe, the Jews were really already on the run. Those that survived the Black Death were really on the run eastwards towards Poland. So the Rishonim technically probably still sort of drift on until the 1500s, but really all the major Rishonim are before the year 1400, and we'll talk about that when we get to the Shulchan Aruch. Just a word about the Black Death there, because it's very, very important. It's hard to overestimate the importance. Okay, fine. That's your 500-year overview of the Rishonim. I hope that was useful. Let's go back to the Rif. Okay, here's a nice little picture of North Africa. Go to sheet 46. I've never been to North Africa. Anyone here been to North Africa?
Is that like Morocco?
Morocco, yes.
Yeah.
You've been to Morocco?
Yeah,
to Tangier. Excellent.
We went from Spain.
Well, it's very close. Here, look.
Yeah, that's
what we did. Straight over. Okay, from Gibraltar, whatever. So if you look here, the three major North African communities, which today are separate countries, are Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia. Now, back in the time of the Rift, they weren't three separate countries. They were just like North Africa. And some of it was even under Christian rule at the beginning. Of course, if you go one over from Tunisia, where do you get to today? What's the next country over to the east from Tunisia? No, we had that. That's to the west. There's Morocco, Algeria. There's Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia.
Egypt.
Yes, Egypt's at the end. Who's there?
Libya.
Okay. Libya is there. So that's basically, that today is North Africa. But again, in the days of the Rif, these countries were just regions. They didn't really exist as such. The Rif's life is fascinating. He was born, as I said, in Algeria, out in the middle there. He moved to Fez. Fez is in Morocco, right?
Well,
yes.
I hate
Fez.
That is hilarious.
What?
Fez. It's an
acid
on the head, and it was funny.
Oh. Okay, I didn't get it yet. Oh, it's a hat, the little red hat. Yeah, yeah. Okay. the Fez. That's why he's called Yitzchak Alpasi, because Yitzchak from Fez. He studied, however, in a number of places. He studied in Karwan, which is in Tunisia. So he was all over that whole area. His teachers were Rabbeinu Nissim, Rabbeinu Chanana. We talked about that. He got married on a famous day. He got married on the same day as the royal wedding. Except he wasn't part of the royal wedding. The Rabbeinu Nissim's daughter and Rav Shmuel Hanavi's son got married on the same day. As each other, obviously, because they got married to each other. But they got married on the same day as the Rif, and that's just famous because that was in somewhere around 1030-ish that he got married then. He started working on his magnum opus, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes, which is the Sefer Halachas of the Rif, which you were learning just before. He worked for around 10 years on this in his father-in-law's attic. He was then very late in life. Before we get there, he was forced to flee for a while because of anti-Jewish persecution. He came back, he became a god of Lador, and then, at the age of 75, and this is really fascinating in terms of the hashkosh of his life, when he was a very old man, and 75 was ancient in those days, he was forced to flee. There were Jewish people reporting against him, they didn't like him, a lot of politics. He had a very difficult life with lots of community politics. There were informers against him, including apparently his own family members, who informed on him to the non-Jewish authorities, that he had to flee, he had to leave North Africa. So he went at the age of 75 up into Spain. He arrived in Spain, which the little piece that I gave you to read talks about how they greeted him with great pomp and circumstance, etc. And eventually he became a major figure in Cordoba and Lucena in Spain, and that's where he died. Now what's fascinating, he literally was 90, which was almost unprecedented in those days. Secondly, it was only in Spain, when he established his yeshiva in Spain, that he actually connected with the Rimigash. And the Rimigash is the one that became the main successor of the Rif. So I can imagine as he was leaving North Africa, as he was running away, he must have felt to himself that his whole life's work had been, you know, for nothing, because all that he'd achieved in North Africa is being thrown away. And actually his main job was yet to come in Spain, which was to create this genius, the Rimigash, who became the Rebbe of the Rambam's father. And the Rambam himself saw himself very much as a student of the Rif, because of his father's connection with the Rimigash. And there he died in Spain. There was a lot of machlokas in Spain as well, and he brought you that story in the middle there. One of his main opponents, Rav Yitzchak Albali, there was a big machlokas in Spain when he arrived. Obviously, another big person arrives, lots of politics, lots of unhappiness. And on his deathbed, Rabbi Yitzchak Albali asked his son to beg forgiveness from the Rif, and eventually there was a reconciliation, and the Rif kind of almost adopted him as one of his own children, and he died there in Spain.
The Rif's wife and children, did they flee with him to Spain?
I think so, but I don't know for sure. I think so, I believe so. I believe he went... one source that I saw actually said that one of his children was one of the people responsible for informing him to the community.
But then not that child.
So, but I can't verify that. His students, famous ones, as I said, Rimigash, Rav Yehuda Levi, Rav Moshe Ibn Ezra, cousin of Rav Avram and Ezra, Ibn Ezra. But for our purposes, I want to talk about the Sefer Halachas. You learned a little bit from the Rif, okay? A little bit you learned at the beginning from our Rav Sofer. So you saw how that worked. What does the Rif do?
Yeah.
Right. He basically does the following. He takes the Gemara. This is what he decided to do. Rather than writing a halachic codification of the specific halachas, he took the Gemara that was all the practical bits of the Gemara. He left out anything that he figured was not practical halacha l'maisa. That's why, by the way, in terms of the Gemara in Pesachim, the Gemara is already on daf 115, but the Rif is only on daf 25. Why? Because he left out almost the whole of the Gemara Pesachim, because it deals with what? Korbanos. Korban Pesach. He says, I'm not interested in giving you stuff which is... So you can go read the Gemara. I don't want you to stop reading the Gemara. But he took a whiteout pen to the Gemara, and a little black pen of his own, as it were, and he just wiped out everything in the Gemara that he feels is not halacha l'maisa. Entire masechtas, opinions, debates within the Gemara, all the different shitas that are not halacha l'maisa, all the agadata. He takes it all out, and occasionally he adds a couple of words of his own, and he says, you know, our practice is this, the minhag is that, we pass it like this, and therefore he brings here the bit that I gave you as to how many pieces of matzah to use on Pesach. So he passes in the end 1.5. says we should use 1.5 because you normally use 2. He says, no, even on Yom Tov you have 2 loaves of bread. On Pesach you have Lechem Oini, which takes away 1.5. I'm not going into the whole thing. I just want you to get a feel for the style of the riff, and that's what he does. On every sugi lemaisa, he brings down the main Gemaras, the main Shitas, the Mishnah, Halacha lemaisa, on we go. Okay? So that's why the riff is a much smaller book than the Gemara. Where would you find the riff? If you were looking for it in the library. In the back of every Gemara, you will find, I didn't bring my, oh, here's my Gemara. Here's my Pesachim that I'm using to teach Gemara this afternoon. So here's my Pesachim, okay? So the actual Gemara Pesachim only goes up to here, okay? That's the end of the Gemara. So this is the Gemara, okay? With commentaries, obviously. So after here, you end up with different commentaries. That's the Rosh, which we'll talk about another time. Then in the back of every Gemara, you'll see something that to the uninitiated also looks like the Gemara. Okay? Let's find him. Here. People pick up this and they open me and say, oh, that's the Gemara. That's, of course, not the Gemara. That is the Riff. How do you know it's the Riff? Because it says Rabbeinu Nissim on the top, which is very difficult to understand. Why does it say Rabbeinu Nissim on the top? Because he's the commentary down the side. If you look for a second, can I put that there? If you look for a second on my sheet, on page 3, where I brought you a template of the Rosh's, of the Riff's print. Now, obviously, when the Vilna Shas was printed back in the 1800s, they decided to put the Riff in the back of every Masechta that has Riff on it. So this is what a classic Riff, page of Riff, looks like. And you'll see, again, if I would have been printing, I would have written Riff on the top so everyone knows, but they didn't do that. They just wrote Rabbeinu Nissim, who's the commentary, and you have various other people on the page. A couple of people you need to know about. First of all, number 1 in the middle is the Riff. Number 2 is Rabbeinu Nissim. And the other people you need to know about on the bottom, number 3 is someone called the Bala Ma'or. The Bala Ma'or was Zerachia HaLevi. He was one of the rabbis in Provence in the 100 years after the Riff. He disagrees a lot with the Riff. And there were those at the time that felt this was a chutzpah because he was about 17 when he wrote it. Okay? And therefore the Ramban wrote this book, Milchemes Hashem. Milchemes Hashem means the wars of God to defend who? The Riff. Therefore, the Ramban, the same Ramban that wrote the commentary on Chumash, wrote the Milchemes Hashem to defend the Riff against the Bala Ma'or. And there's a whole, so that's one of the classic, when you're in Yeshiva learning a Sugya V'Ian, that sort of triangle of Riff, Bala Ma'or, Ramban, the Ramban often agrees with the Bala Ma'or, but he wants to show how the Riff reached his sack to defend him, etc. So that's a very important limb of the people.
The Bala Ma'or was 17?
Yeah, very young. I think he was a late teenager, early 20s when he wrote on the Riff. He was a genius. He's a genius. Ramban, Nachmanides. And then the Rivet at the bottom is the Rivet that we have on the Rambam as well, but it's a commentary on the Riff. Ah, only in Brochus. In Brochus, you find Rabbeinu Yonah on the Riff, because for whatever reason, the Ran didn't have a commentary on the Riff, or doesn't get printed on the Riff in Brochus. But that's the Talmidei Rabbeinu Yonah appear, the tree, they appear on Brochus. That's because you're learning Brochus, and then that's what you know about. Now, what did the Riff do by creating this commentary? A few very important things that you need to be aware of. Number one, he incorporated many psakim of his teachers, of the Ga'onim, particularly Rabbeinu Chananel. Okay, particularly Rabbeinu Chananel, that becomes very important. Number two, he became a source for some very important people. First of all, the Rambam, like I said, the Rambam saw himself as a Talmud very much of the Riff. He never met the Riff. He never even really met the Rimigash. There is a story when the Rambam was a little boy, 5 or 6 years old, his father, Rabbeinu Maimon, brought him to meet the Rimigash, who was a very old man on his deathbed. And the Rambam writes that he says that meeting with this old Rimigash had an impact, but he never studied. He had more of a kind of spiritual impact than anything else. But the Rambam says he only disagrees with the Riff in 30 places, which is almost nothing. The Rambam paskens hundreds of thousands of halachas. He says he disagreed with the Riff in 30 places, and therefore sees himself as very much a Talmud of the Riff. Secondly, when the Shulchan Aruch later in the 16th century decided to write the Shulchan Aruch, he picked 3 major pillars of psak from the Rishonim. One of them was the Riff. One of them was the Rambam. And the other one was the Rosh. Okay?
That's not fair.
because it's two basically the same.
Yeah.
Yes, and that's what the Ramah says when he says, you know something, this book is fantastic, but it's a little bit Sephardi focused, because the Shulchan Aruch was written for the whole Jewish world. And the Ramah said, can we kind of Ashkenazi it up a bit? Because the Rif and the Rambam are really coming from the same place. And even the Rosh lived in Spain by the end. So we'll get to that when we get to that. But the Rif became therefore very, very important in Halacha. I think probably more important than he ever thought he would be. Just from his base in North Africa, he ends up being the foundation of the Rambam and the foundation of the Shulchan Aruch as well. He's sometimes called the Talmud HaKatan. He also survived the censor. The Christians banned study of the Talmud for many, many hundreds of years. But they allowed people to learn the Rif. Don't know. Maybe they figured that it was like the Talmud was what they really were, had it in for, but the Rif was okay. So the Rif became, just by default, the thing that many people ended up learning for all that period of time. Therefore, that's why it became one of the most important Sfarim. Other things that the Rif did, he produced 320 tshuvas, which we have, which are also very critical, very important in terms of the analysis of the period. Now, that's what I want to say about the Rif for now. But what I want to do is begin to speak a little bit about the Rambam. Okay? Any questions on the Rif? Those of you who didn't get the Rambam, I want to give out the Rambam now. Okay. Who did not get the Rambam? Okay. Yeah, let me give you a Rambam. Rambam. You got one, Chaya?
Yes.
Rambam. Sorry, did you get Rambam? You did not get the Rambam. You guys got the Rambam? Why don't I have any Rambams? Second. Roll the Rambam. Who's throwing the Rambam on the floor? Okay, so what's second? There. Is that all the Rambams? Okay, I don't have any enough, but maybe you'll just have to share just for a second. Do you mind sharing this for a second? Guys, if you don't have access to Rambam, just look at someone else for a second. I just want to begin talking about the Rambam, and then I want to end. First of all, in terms of the... just let me show you these. Well, before we get there, where am I going to start here? Maybe I can start the Rambam next time. Nope, there's a little bit of time left here. You want to finish here, Abby? Let me just say a few words about the Rambam and then we'll finish. What I want you to do next time, by the way, is when you bring this sheet to class, go straight up to the Beit Midrash, okay? Start reading through, read through from sources 1. Through to source number 4. It won't take you very long. It's all in English. It's pretty much all in English. It's very, it'll be very quick. And then what I'll do is I'll go through the Rambam next time and I'll give you the Rosh. That'll be perfect. Because then by Thursday, the end of Thursday's class, we'll have covered the Rif, the Rambam. No, on Thursday. It'll be Thursday when we have the class on the Rambam. We'll have covered the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rosh. Just let me say a few things about the Rambam as a beginning. First of all, I've given you all sorts of goodies on this sheet. I've given you a picture on the front of which is almost certainly not the Rambam at all. The Rambam, this is just a picture somebody drew a long time later, which could be any Islamic or Jewish figure of importance. Yeah, and you see all the stamps, you know, the stamps that I brought you, world stamps featuring the Rambam. I couldn't resist it, really. Because, you know, they're all based on the same basic picture. Yes, because that is based on the statue that they created in Cordoba. If you go to Cordoba, there's a statue they made of the Rambam, and that's, I think, what the statue looks like. But you're right, he's the only one who's looking, if you like, towards the...
Yes.
Like who? No. Anyway, you can... You can think about that.
Oh, I see that.
Jurisprudence is the philosophy of the legal system. Okay. Why did you read jurisprudence?
Other pages of the Torah work to their alum, but plus the last one.
Okay, fine. Jurisprudence is, my official course at university was called jurisprudence. That's what I studied officially. But it really wasn't about jurisprudence at all. So, there was a little bit of philosophy of law. So the Rambam, we don't know what he looked like. We have no clue. This picture is the one that does the rounds. For some reason, which is inexplicable to me, this picture in various places on Facebook tags as me. I have no idea why that is. I think somebody must have done some kind of a joke, because I can assure you it is not me, and it is almost an embarrassment to be even associated in that sense with some of the people think is a Rambam, because of the great godless of the Rambam, and I'm sure he would not be one to associate with me. He would not be on Facebook either, yes.
The signature, is that real?
Yes, the signature is, however, real. The signature of the Rambam we have in many cases because we have his works, his ksaviyat, we have his manuscripts. Have them before, but we also have them from the Cairo Geniza. We spoke a little bit about the Cairo Geniza, one of the main shuls in Fostat in Cairo, what's that?
I think it could be the Rambam, because you're Rabbi Manning Ben Manning.
Yes, well, I'm not, I can assure you, in case you ever got that wrong. So we have his original signature. There are many places in the Bodleian Library in Oxford. You can call it the Rambam from the stacks. They have the original manuscripts of the Rambam. One of my friends was working on a PhD, because Oxford and Cambridge have many of the greatest manuscripts in the world. Vatican also has, obviously, enormous amounts of manuscripts. But one of my friends was working on a PhD in Oxford, and he asked the Bodleian Library, he was a member, obviously, to call up the original manuscript of the Rambam, which was incredibly valuable. So they looked at him and he said, yeah, I need it for research, whatever. So they called it up. So he's sitting there at his desk in the university with his cup of coffee like this, and they plopped it on the desk in front of him, looked at his coffee and said, do be careful, old chap, it's rather valuable. In classic English style, you know, whoops, like it's here. But we know that this is definitely the signature of the Rambam from all of those many manuscripts that we have. What we also found, fascinatingly, in the Cairo Geniza, were working drafts of the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, where you see him crossing, where, you know, he wrote like Chayev, and then he crossed it out and wrote Potter, you know, and crossed it out. Very, very fascinating. You see his mind, if you like, working, going through the sugyas. The Rambam was almost certainly... Yes. Exactly. The Rambam, now you know that there's fame. The Rambam was almost certainly the most important Jew that existed from Moshe Rabbeinu up until present day. That's why they wrote on his kever up in the north. If you go to Tveria, if you've been to Tiberias, you've been to Tveria?
Yeah.
You've been to the kever of the Rambam? There's nothing else to do in Tveria. It's like, there's really nothing to do. If you go there for a day and a half, in 3 hours, you've done everything there is to do. There's that market you walk up and down where they sell all the same junk that they've sold for the last 50 years. And there's like a couple of restaurants. There's a Russian karaoke bar. Other than that, Lahavdil, there is the kever of the Rambam. As a choice of places to go, I feel that the kever of the Rambam is by far the best.
As women visiting
his kever? I see why the Rambam would have an issue. The Rambam was responsible for a lot of women's education in Fostat.
Like, when you want people visiting his kever, because he's so against, like...
Guess what? People going to, like, to... Okay, good. That's a good question. I don't know.
I don't mean because we're women. I mean because visiting the kever...
Right. I understand. I don't know if the answer to that. It depends what you do at his kever. If you use his kever as an opportunity to connect yourself in tefillah to the Ribbono Shel Olam, I'm sure he'd feel that that was a positive thing. But if you pray to the Rambam, I'm sure he'd rather that wasn't done at all, because you're over on a number of Yisurei Daraisa. I personally feel that going to the kever of the Rambam is special, because next to him is buried his father. And I actually feel that to daven at the kever of his father, for the schus of having children who are Talmidei Chachamim, is probably the greatest father of a Talmid Chacham that there ever was. He was, of course, a master Talmid Chacham himself, but I personally feel quite moved by his father's kever, and there are also his other children there. There are also Tanayim, not his children, but his grandchildren. There are also Tanayim buried there as well, from Rabbi Ami, Rabbi Yassi, around the corner, etc. I think Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai is there too. It's a real Makom Kvura which you need to go to. to. So the truth is, I'm not going to get now into the whole life of the Rambam. There's too much to do. You can look yourself next time. Next time what I'd like you to do, please, is I'd like you to read those five Makoros or four Makoros that I brought you, and then read the equivalent on page 11, where there's that bit in the middle, which is from that fellow Sefer again, on the life of the Rambam. And then we will hopefully really get to grips with that next time and finish with the Rosh, and then you will have a good hakdama to the formation of the Shulchan Aruch, Be'ezrat Hashem. Okay, we'll leave.